So as you sit here in St. John's this morning, would you say that your life is prosperous? Would you say that your life is a success? If you're thinking the answer to those questions may not be yes, what lengths would you go to in order to make your life prosperous and successful? Now, that success you have in mind might be getting some better A-level results that will allow you to go to university of your choice. Or success might be just getting through another week. That prosperity might be booking your second skiing holiday of the upcoming winter. Or it might be just about managing. Would you take Princess Diana's reported advice to William and Harry, be as naughty as you like, just don't get caught? If you were to put into Google what is needed to be successful, what is needed to be prosperous, then these are some of the things that will pop up. The answers will say, it's all about you. Want it enough. Work hard enough. Believe enough, and you can have it. The advice will tell you, you're not to let other people put you down. Don't be afraid of failure. Follow your intuition. Don't be afraid of new ideas. Know what you love to do and do it. If you were to try to be more prosperous and more successful, what part might God play in that? To what extent would you involve him in your plans? Well, this morning in Judges, we meet a man, Micah, and we meet a tribe, Dan, who want to prosper and who want to succeed. And for them, religion means a lot. For them, getting God on side was absolutely essential to prosperity and success. The problem is, they go about it in a way that is right in their own eyes. Just as we might decide to follow our favourite celebrity's yoga tips, or the latest self-help guru's guide to mindfulness, or the latest business management success bestseller. Yes, we'll just go with the wisdom of our times. What does verse 6 of chapter 17 say? In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. We've talked about the book being a downward spiral. That's the message at the heart of the book. And in these last two sort of incidents, we see that they have reached the very bottom. Here, we see it in their spiritual life, in their religious life. They are no longer distinctive at all from the people among whom they live. They act as they see fit, with little or no reference to their covenant God at all. So let's see what Micah and the Danites do to prosper and succeed. What are the secrets of their success, if any? What are the lessons that we need to learn? Well, let's begin with chapter 17 and Micah's plan to prosper. And we see very clearly in this account that prosperity comes by stealing. From the very outset, theft follows theft. So we meet Micah in verse 1. Verse 2, he says to his mother, the 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse, and also spoken in my ears, behold, the silver is with me, I took it. Micah is a thief. But then so is his mother. He restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, verse 3. His mother said, I declare, I dedicate the silver to the Lord from my hand. But then look to verse 4. How many pieces of silver were there? 1,100, yes. How many pieces did she dedicate to the Lord in verse 4? 200. What's happened to the other 900? Where have they gone? She promises 11, she gives him 2, she steals from the Lord. We might also say Micah steals a job from his son. He makes his son priest, but then takes that job away from him when a better option turns up. But above all, they steal from their covenant Lord. They create their own shrine. Micah has a shrine, verse 5. Micah's delight, therefore, in verse 13, is undermined from the very start. Then Micah said, Now that I've got this priest in place, now that I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest. Micah's desire to be prosperous is fatally flawed. It's a fake security built on nothing other than his wishful thinking. Yes, thanks to his mother, he's got a carved image and a metal image. He has made an ephod, this sort of cloth that covers everything, and the household gods. And now he's got a proper priest, a Levite, who just happened to turn up. Verse 8 says he was looking for a place. That is, he was looking for a position. And lo and behold, here is just that position. Yes, Micah is in clover. He thinks he's got it made. He thinks life will now be just what he wants it to be and all he's been looking forward to it being. Because now, with his shrine and his gods and his priest, God must be pleased with him, surely. After all, he's committed himself religiously, hasn't he? He's gone to a lot of trouble. He's now offering great devotion to God. He has done what is right. And his friends and neighbors would have applauded him for doing just that. But of course, there is another and a greater theft here, isn't there? Let's have the first slide up, Ruth, please. Both Micah and his mother, have a God who has said, you shall have no other gods before me. A God who has said, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything. You shall not bow down to them and serve them. God has spoken. And they have decided to do the exact opposite of what God has said. They have robbed him of the devotion and the service and the praise and the adoration that belongs to him alone. So the blessing which his mother wished on Micah in verse 2, blessed be my son by the Lord, is an empty blessing. There is no blessing. There is no prosperity down the route they have chosen. Only judgment. And judgment falls on Micah. It falls on Micah when he too is robbed. When the Danites come and take everything. Look at verse 24 of chapter 18. Just glance across the column there. He rather pathetically says to the Danites, you take my gods that I made and the priest and go away. And what have I left? How then do you ask me, what is the matter with you? What have I left? You see, all Micah ever had was this outward show of religion. This shrine and these gods which he had made himself and the priest which he had appointed himself. There is no reality of a relationship with God here. There's no life lived devoted to this God. There's no heart understanding of what knowing and serving this God must mean? What he has gone. What he has was completely contrary to what God said he should have. Prosperity, so longed for by Micah, can never come via this route. Because everyone who does what is right in their own eyes will face judgment. The God of Israel, the creator God of this world, cannot be mocked. Let's turn from the individual, Micah, to the tribe, Dan. Let's look at Dan's steps to success. And here too, success comes by stealing. Can we get rid of the picture, please, Ruth? Thank you. The Danites steal from Micah. They then steal from the inhabitants of Laish. But above all, they too steal from the Lord their God. Verse 1 chapter 18 tells us that Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in. Yes, they had been given an allotment originally as Israel came into the land, but they of all the tribes had failed most miserably to secure it for themselves. Back in chapter 1, we read this: the Amorites pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they didn't allow them to come to the plain. They had never made that initial place their own. And so they look for somewhere else. And as these five spies set out, verse 2, they come across Micah and his place, and they hear the voice of the Levite. Verse 3, when they were by the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. And they turned aside and said to him, "What brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What's your business here?" And he tells them how Micah dealt with him. And so they say to him, verse 5, "Inquire of God, please, that we may know whether the journey on which we are setting out will succeed." Unsurprisingly, the Levite says, "It will. Go in peace. The journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord." Let's have a look at the map now, Ruth, please. Thank you. They start from there. That's where their initial allotment was. And they end up in the north. Oh, it's gone. That's annoying. Oh, no, it hasn't. There it is, after all. Above there. The town of Sidon is just off to the left of that top red circle. Verse 7. They came to Laish and saw the people who were there, how they lived in security after the manner of Sidonians, quiet and unsuspecting, lacking nothing that is in the earth, and possessing wealth, and how they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with them. This looks like an ideal place to settle. There are echoes of Land of Milk and Honey in the way in which all this is described, and so they report back. Yes, you can take it away now, Ruth, thank you. They decide they will make the move. Verse 11, so 600 men of the tribe of Dan, armed with weapons, set out. They go through Judah, they start heading north up through Ephraim. And once again, they decide to stop off at Micah's. Then the five men, verse 14, who had gone to scout out the country of Laish, said to their brothers, "Don't you know that in these houses are an ephod, household gods, a carved image and a metal image? Now, therefore, consider what you will do." Well, is this by design? Was the plan always to take these gods for themselves? You'll notice how each time you get the same refrain mentioned. It's meant to make us not just recognize what's happening, but slightly chuckle at what is going on. So they come to the house. Micah looks as though he's out. The Levite's in. And verse 15, they ask him about his welfare. How friendly. Reacquaint themselves. And then we get the sort of the menace. Verse 16. Now the 600 men of the Danites, armed with their weapons of war, stood by the entrance of the gate. So the five have gone up to the front door. They've knocked. They're having a bit of a chat. But just behind them, over the shoulder, he can see 600 armed men. The menace, the threat is clearly there, isn't it? So when they therefore come and take the shrine and the gods and himself, there's nothing he can do about it. End of verse 17, we're reminded the 600 armed men are still by the gates. What else can he possibly do? He slightly objects in verse 18, what are you doing? They say, keep quiet. They say, come with us. It's better for you to be a priest to the house of one man or to be a priest to a tribe and a clan in Israel. Well, that's obvious, isn't it? You want the promotion, wouldn't you? You take it. And he's pleased. He's glad. Look, verse 20, the priest's heart was glad. And he plays his part in taking what he once served at Micah's fall. So they set off, they've stolen the shrine and everything else. They shake off the rather pathetic efforts of Micah to stop them. As expected, they easily defeat the people of Laish. Verse 27, again, this sort of phrase, they came to Laish to people quiet and unsuspecting and struck them with the edge of the sword. They rebuild the city, and the Levite, he gets a state-of-the-art new shrine. Verse 30, the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves. It's got great lighting, it's got new heating, the sound system's sensational, the PowerPoint works brilliantly, and it's got a fantastic coffee machine. It's an ideal place, and it all belongs to the Levite. Just what anybody would want. What do you notice? Well, there are two things to notice, aren't there? One, the Lord has said nothing throughout this, and there is no conclusion. We're not told what God thinks about what the Danites have done. We're not told what might be about to happen. Our author gives us two final thoughts. Look back to verse 30. He tells us who this Levite is and what his lineage is. And it's a bit of a shock, isn't it? And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, son of Moses, descendant of Moses, and his two sons were priests of the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. We've seen before with the story of Gideon that passing on the role is not necessarily a good thing, because a good lineage doesn't guarantee good character, it doesn't guarantee devotion to Yahweh. So clearly it doesn't happen with Moses' line either. And we notice from the final verse, they set up Micah's carved image as long as the house of God was in Shiloh. This is again the Danites doing what is right in their eyes. The sort of the central Israelite place at this moment was Shiloh. It's where all the big decisions were taken. It's where people came to meet. And it was where the Ark of the Covenant that they brought out of Israel, out of Egypt, was resting. But no, the Danites want their own place. They want to do it their own way. And is there just a hint of the future at the end of verse 30? The day of the captivity of the lands? Are we being given a hint as to what God's judgment is going to be? Because surely there will be judgment, won't there? After what happened to Micah, surely it must happen to the Danites. They've behaved the same way, haven't they? They've robbed the covenant God just as Micah did. Judgment must be coming. Because there cannot be success by such a route. They too have done what is right in their own eyes. But their God will not be mocked. So in a world where everyone does what is right in their own eyes, let's have these two conclusions. First of all, there can be no prosperity or success without knowing the Creator. This sad tale of downward spiral is the story of God's people. It's the story of the church. So our main focus must not be on the ways of the world. We're not talking here about the crooked businessman who has it all, but with apparently no comeback. We're talking about the church. We're talking about those who claim to be Christian believers, yet who think they can enjoy God's blessing while ignoring what he has said. Doing what is right in my own eyes means choosing a lifestyle and choosing a behavior which I think will please God without reference to what the creator of the universe has said. I know better than God. I choose my own way. I decide what word I will hear, what word I will follow. And that applies, of course, to institutional, denominational structures just as much as it does to individual church gatherings and individual believers. We have a choice. We listen to what God says and do it his way, or we do it our own way that fits in with the world's way. But God is not mocked. There is no success, there is no prosperity down this route. Judgment is coming on all who do what is right in their own eyes. Secondly, there can be no knowing the Creator without Jesus. There can be no knowing the Creator without Jesus. You see, the attitude that is around today is that I'm not going to be told what to believe or how to behave. And yes, I think there could be many ways up the mountain to get to God. I really do like the thought of picking a bit from here and a bit from there and a practice from there and a prayer from over there. That will suit me fine. So yes, we'll have a bit of yoga and mindfulness. We'll have a bit of Kabbalah and I'll see what the horoscope's saying. After all, the England cricket captain says he believes in God, so there must be hope, mustn't there? That sort of pick and mix spirituality suits me. I choose, I remain in control. And if that means I'll rewrite the good news, then that's what I'll do. Because after all, talk of sin and judgment just don't fit in with how people want to be talked to today, do they? There's no need for repentance anymore. There's no need to talk about Jesus' death as a sacrifice anymore. That's all too difficult. Leave that to one side. Let's talk about a God who loves us and wants us all to know him and invites us all to come to him instead. And that God might be Krishna or Allah or female or whatever. Can we have the slide up, Ruth, please? And the next one. Thank you. But Jesus said these words: I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. You may only know the Creator through his Son, Jesus. You may only come into a relationship with the Creator through the death of his Son, Jesus. So don't be thrown by the appearance of choice. Don't be thrown by the fact that maybe some people you have thought highly of in the past seem to be promoting such alternatives. There is only one Creator, and there's only one way to that Creator. Jesus and Jesus alone is the path to prosperity and success. Some years ago, I attended a funeral. It was the funeral of the youngest daughter of the couple who had led the youth group while I was at church. And in the prayers, the guy who led the prayers gave thanks that she had reached the potential for which she had been created. In other words, she'd come to know, love, and serve the Lord Jesus and to know God through him. That's what she was made for, to know her Creator. And that she had done because of Jesus. That is prosperity and success. So this morning, I want to invite those of you here who don't yet know, love, and serve Jesus to give up going your own way. Give up doing what is right in your eyes according to the wisdom of our age. Turn to this Jesus. And to those of us who are sure of this Jesus, let me encourage us to rejoice in him, to rejoice in the prosperity and success and blessing of knowing Jesus as our rescuer and Lord, and through him, of knowing our Creator God. Because the one we look to is the Jesus who said, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me."